to know where Tao used to connect in his country, you owe yourself to visit the old mines. Be it for coal or for iron, that is where the politics and the nature of the nation seem to have come together at one time or the other. Those special places where the poor and rich, native and immigrant, came together, working and living so close, and showing the best and the worst in them, like they did on the iron range. Possibly it is fate of each place of hard work and harsh conditions to be the mirror for the nation, to capture what was going on at the time, like modern kid with camera phone snaps a minute of video from the important game. Old minds are those very snatched away minutes of a great game of American history. And they're still standing there, besides their towns and their communities, standing there and waiting for us, or for return of the better future.
Dear Lord in heaven, please rest my soul beneath that cold dark ground. Yeah, when I die. Dear Lord in heaven, please rest my soul.
Welcome to one of those places. Sudan Underground Mine, Vermilion Range, Minnesota.
As the elevator takes you down 2,341 feet to the level 27 of Sudan Mine, at a speed of about 1,000 feet a minute, which makes it feel almost like you're falling down in an iron box about quarter size of a usual elevator, well, you have about a minute and a half to brush up on history before you hit the ground. It all started in 1865 with a man who got it all wrong. Henry Eames, Minnesota state geologist, made a mistake that led him to believe that there was gold on mountainous range in northern Minnesota. Wouldn't be such a big mistake. However, he made the announcement in the heart of St. Paul. Within months, people were flocking to the range looking for that non-existent gold. The gold rush lasted 1 year only, and no one made any money save the teamsters selling equipment and the stores dealing in food and booze. Yet without this failed gold rush, the history of Tower Sudan area would be very different. First of all, it was on Christmas of 1866 that the range was named Vermilion Range. Second, the failed gold rush brought iron to the iron range, in form of broken and lost equipment. No more than quarter century later, people of Tower and Sudan appreciated all that useful metal lying around, and the Minnesota Iron Company, grateful for cut expenses, had even commissioned a barge to pick it up and carry it to Duluth, so it could be converted into nails used for building companies' houses. And finally, Rush attracted a man without whom Tower Sudan venture simply wouldn't happen, a prospector from Duluth named George Stans. In 1865, Stans, just like all others, failed to find gold. However, he did notice the outcrops of iron ore and took some samples. Although it could be just an ancient Minnesotan legend, some sources about Tower Sudan history mention a certain French fur trader who received the samples of ore in addition to furs from local Native Americans, and finding no use for them, sold the samples to George Stans. And then Stans spent most of the following 10 years trying to find investors to take interest in Vermilion Range iron. In 1867, samples of iron ore were sent to Paris, France, for exposition. In the same year, Smithsonian Institution took notice of the ore and sent 100 boxes with samples to various researchers to study. But still, there was no money coming. Did you notice what just happened? You arrived. On the bottom of the mine, it is always pretty dark and cold. Temperature does not waver far of 50 degrees Fahrenheit. However, because the rock in the mine, so-called Ely Greenstone, is one of the oldest on planet Earth, there are no methane or other poison gases. There is also little seepage, so hardly a shoe can get wet, and indeed air smells pleasantly of iron rust and stone dust. This was considered to be a dry mine, and miners thought it was easier to work in. And now that you're here, what you're going to do next? Right. You're going to wait for a train. Meanwhile, back in late 1800s, finally in 1875, it came down to a different George. Duluth banker George Stone, who contacted Charlemagne Tower of Philadelphia. Tower was interested in building railroads through Vermilion Ranch, and saw mining as a good bonus. Thus, between those three men, Tower, Stone, and Stuntz, the history of Vermilion Ranch and Sudan iron mining had begun. Of course, once you own the ranch, the history twists itself around a bit. In metro area, down here in Minneapolis, it's all about record keeping and books and magazines. And on the ranch, it's all about families and people. Indeed, people like a third-generation miner and Sudan historian Andy Larson make that complex beginning sound like family history. And in that family, Charlemagne Tower is a rich uncle who never comes to visit.
Well, he was never here. His son was, after a while. His son was kind of a vice president of the company. But Charlemagne was too old. He never came. He had the money. And he pretty much went broke developing this. But
he went broke? He didn't make
any money? Not quite. But he almost did. He was afraid for a while. Because it took a lot of money to get it started. They had to build a railroad all the way from Lake Superior up to here, yeah. Two harbors. And that cost them a lot of money. And then to build two towns, essentially, and develop it.
What about the Stone guy? The George Stone.
George Stone was a banker out of Duluth. He kind of worked for Tower, I think. He lined up and got a hold of a lot of the land around here.
Yeah.
And George Stuntz was a surveyor and an explorer. He was involved for a while. Eventually, when it started making money, so once he got it operating, they found out that Tower was making money. Then some of the other big money guys back east, Rockefeller and McCormick and a bunch of these guys. You know, the whole big money crew.
Mm-hmm. Just invested.
They formed what eventually became U.S. Steel. And so they eventually forced Tower to kind of sell out. Because some of the land he'd gotten on a little bit shaky basis, maybe. And, you know, it was very common at that time. There was homesteaders. You could claim to homestead a land, you know, but you're supposed to build a house there, a shack at least, and clear some land. But they would say, well, okay, Joe Blow, you'll homesteaded this land over here, you sign it off, and the guy never saw it probably. Yeah, okay, I'll sign it, we'll give you $20 or something.
Wow.
You know, but that was not uncommon in those days. But he acquired a lot of land here, like 17,000 acres or something.
Was he ever investigated for that?
No, because everybody did it. But they put pressure on him because they could have, you know, but so they kind of forced him to sell.
Although it wasn't just the land that had to be acquired. Because early on, Tower and Stone realized that they have to come up with very skilled people to work the mines in those harsh conditions. The work was hard, both in the beginning, when most of mining at Sudan was done by drill and dynamite in open pits, and later, when it was still done by drill and dynamite, but now under the ground. As a result, early on, a lot of workers came from Finland, Cornwall, England, and Italy, all the mining areas of Europe which were in decline by mid-1800s. Later, by 1890s, when it became apparent that for many reasons it's both cheaper and safer for mines to hire immigrants, the Minnesota Iron Company began sending agents to Eastern Europe, looking for not just skilled workers with mining experience, but about anyone who would sign up.
Well, there was a little place down here they call Swedetown. There was a bunch of Swedes living there.
What about like Finns and Italians?
In some towns, places around here had a Finn town, and generally they got along. They had things occasionally that happened that some of the people from the old country, from Europe, were superstitious. I remember when I was a kid, there was they talked about a whistling ghost. You hear this whistling every once in a while. Yeah, and there was some guys. We're kind of afraid of that. Well, it turns out it was just a leak in an air pipe that would whistle.
And yet, once in a while, there would be just enough people of one or the other ethnicity sharing the tradition or a holiday that they more or less presumed that everyone else did the same. And if it wasn't so, well, that could lead to clash with management, such as foremen, mining captains, or even to a clash with fellow miners.
In 1892, they had a kind of a skirmish here, and it was more of a ethnic thing.
Mm-hmm.
There was a bunch of Southern Europeans, Italians, Slovenians maybe. In the old country, there was a day, St. Christopher's Day or St. Somebody's Day.
Mm-hmm.
It was a holiday.
Yeah.
So they all stayed home. And the Cousin Jacks who ran the mine, that wasn't a holiday where they come from. So they were mad. Why are you guys all staying home? And pretty soon they got scrapping back and forth, and then there was a little drinking involved at one point too, I guess. And
well,
then,
at least those were kind of holiday.
But then they wound up, the guys put the fires out and the boilers, everything ran on steam here then, and they were a lot of hooting and hollering and yelling, and they called the National Guard or somebody up. The guys were chasing each other around the woods with guns, and I don't think anybody got shot or anything, but finally they caught a few guys and put them in jail and everything settled down. But it was just a misunderstanding that started it, because it was a holiday for some people, it wasn't for the other people, and that kind of thing happened once in a while.
Underground. By now, the train that got you to your workplace has already left. And consider yourself lucky. Most likely you got on a train while the bus wasn't watching, because the Minnesota Iron Company considers train fit for moving ore only. People get to walk. You have a hard day ahead of you. First of all, your crew got to make the contract, which is a set amount of iron ore that you got to mine every day. Let's hope that the bus didn't see you hopping on the underground train. He decides where your crew gets to work today, and if he did see you, he will put you in a place where there is nothing but the empty, eely greenstone. Pretty to look at, but useless otherwise. Even if not, in case you are short of contracted amount of ore, you don't get paid at all. Another thing which makes your day oh so much a bucket of joy is the fact that you can hardly chit-chat with your crew. It is likely that none of you guys can speak English, and since you are working with Bohemian, Slovenian, Finn, and Swede, you are more or less communicating in gestures. So easy to do in the dark. And finally, you had just broken a drill bit. Or your dynamite is wet. Or one of the guys got hurt. Which means all the expenses will come out of the crew members' pockets. Company holds you responsible for all damages to men and equipment day or night while on company's property. And now about the men who stood between the company, its rules and policies, and the workers underground. Sharon Morcom, the fifth generation relative of Elisha Morcom, the famous early mining captain, has been working on transcribing the book of his letters to Charlemagne, because while he was not the first captain to be invited to Tower Sudan operations, he was the first one trusted with enough materials and cash money to more or less literally build and run the mine.
He told me that he got his first mining accident
when he was 9 years old.
And he was still in Cornwall.
Yes.
Yes, and then he became a professional miner and immigrated to US at 19.
Mm-hmm.
And then he came here and became a first captain. Was he hired as a captain?
Yes, he was. He was hired to get this operation running. The first guy who came actually came in 1882. And he was a mine engineer, and his name was Prince. And he suffered frostbite the first year. Oh. It took most of the second year to recuperate. But one of the things Lisha mentioned in his letters is that it's difficult to come in a place, and here this guy's been here for 2 years, and then Lisha was put in charge, so Prince had to work under him.
Oh, God. So they had quite skirmishes, probably.
I'm sure they did, some. Because he did mention to Tower that he realized that that was a difficult position for Prince to be put in.
Yeah, so it seems like he really cared for the men, though.
Yes, I think he did.
He cared for the men who worked under him.
Mm-hmm. And their wives, the guys who got killed, I would see, well, it was hard to have money here. Everything had to come from Duluth.
Yeah.
And so he bought all kinds of stamps, 1 cent stamps, I think they were. In fact, we've seen boxes of them for years. And he would pay off, like, this low insurance policy to the widows in stamps. Like, say, if the widow was back in Norway, for one, I think she was in Norway. So he sent her, like, an insurance policy in stamps, trying to make sure she got her money from.
Okay, so she was able to then exchange the stamps for money?
Yeah. Kind of explained to him, I'm sending you this because we can't get cash here. And it's the only way I can send you this amount.
And because he was an immigrant himself, Elisha understood how the laws of the company were written in such a way as not to really benefit workers. Minnesota History magazine recalls how he clashed with the company in 1883, when Minnesota Iron had proclaimed that with a doctor and saloon in town, There will be no reason why men should ask for higher wages than at any other place. And yet it was reported that Minnesota Iron had found the worst physician on the ranch who was willing to relocate to Sudan and work for their salary. Miners still had to pay him for visits, but the physician, named Robert Bell, lacked both the competence, discipline where it came to drink, and kind attitude toward patients. When workers nearly went on strike that year, Elisha, to company's distress, wrote in their support, "This is no way to talk or act to the men. They pay their money for medical services and expect to be treated right."
So when he came here and he had to build all this, and you know, under him were a lot of men, how did he manage to work with all the immigrants from all over the place?
It didn't seem to bother him at all, and being a world traveler, I mean, coming from Gwinnett, England.
You said that after him, the guy who took over after him was Benson?
Bacon.
And that was a different story.
Yes, it was. But they had become U.S. Steel by then. Or Oliver Mining Company, which was the beginning of U.S. Steel. So, see, what happened is when the way Charlemagne Tower got his land, he didn't follow the rules of the land. He had George Stuntz working for him. And George Stuntz would call our White Pine Forest a tamarack swamp, and Charlemagne Tower would buy the land. Then they used the early half-breed law and the Homestead Act, and he tipped the homesteaders a few bucks, got clear title to their land. In fact, there was a time when the Minnesota governor said, you know, I want a homesteader for each contract of land bought.
Well, Charlemagne Tau, I mean, he never set a foot here.
No.
And it's his son who came here.
Yeah, but he made it as far as Duluth. And Leish used to try to talk him into coming here. He used to say, that three-day walk will do your health good. You should come here and see the operation.
So when his son came here with the steel company and Bacon was put in, did anything change for the workers?
I think more meaner production, because by this time John D. Rockefeller and Andrew Carnegie and J.P. Morgan, they're the ones who forced Charlemagne Tower's hand and forced them to sell this, which became Oliver Mining, which was the beginning of U.S. Steel.
Later in 1890s, with the new tighter and more efficient rules, Sudan mine has expanded. At the heyday of operations, Tower Sudan area was a rough, but nonetheless extremely busy and fun town.
At one time, Tower had a population of 5,000 and Sudan had a population of 3. And that's when they had 1,800 guys working this mine. That would have been in the 1890s. It became nuts here. There were 26 taverns on the main street of town. 26.
And towns quite a lot of debauchery then.
Yeah, and houses of ill repute out by the railroad tracks. Go figure.
So at that time, did any women work in the mine at all?
No, not here.
Just men?
Yeah, just men. They considered women a bad luck story.
A bad luck?
Yeah.
So you couldn't even
That's why they renamed the lorry car.
Back at the mine. It is early 1900s now, and it is likely that you are not underground. You are either rioting for higher wages or attempting to organize your fellow workers, or you are at home, since the company shut down the mine in response to recent strikes, and you are reading either Slovenian or Finnish socialist newspaper. Like in most of US, early decades of the 20th century are equivalent here with labor struggle and unionization. Miners of Tower Sudan were in league. By then, of course, the history of the ranch ceased to sound like a family tale and turned into a radio broadcast or a newspaper story from the field of conflict. Aaron Brown, the author of a blog about modern iron ranch called Minnesota Brown and the book Overburden, Modern Life on the Iron Ranch, commented on the later developments.
You could speculate that because the Vermilion Range was probably the most remote of the ranges, it would have been harder to organize there. But it did. There was a good 20 years of very intensive labor battles on the iron ranges of Minnesota as different immigrant groups came in. Essentially, these waves of people were coming in, and the early ones would get here, for instance, the Finns were some of the people who organized early, while they were blacklisted and their strikes got busted, because there's always constantly new immigrants coming in to take the jobs of the striking workers. And then those workers would figure out that, that things weren't right and would unionize, and then they would get replaced by somebody else. And this went on for a while until eventually, actually it was really World War II that ended that cycle, because the demand for iron, for steel was so great that the companies and the government basically said, you know what, we've got to do what we've got to do, and they figured out ways to get along with their workers. And after World War II, it was a whole different era of union management relations. It was that's the range that we know it today, which is an area where the unions are very strong. That happened after World War II.
Vermilion Ranch and Tower Sedan Mines emerged from the throes of worker organizing in early 1900s with a renewed sense of identity. Take, for example, the first attempt by Finnish workers to organize in Sudan area in 1903. John Penninley, a mining captain loyal to Oliver Mining Company, a division of U.S. Steel, had noticed that Finns were organizing all over the neighborhood, so to say, from Sudan to Ely. He responded by banning gatherings in bars that were owned and frequented by Finns. Within months, Slovenians and Swedes joined the movement. The movement they were previously not as interested in, and offered their houses and establishments for Finnish socialists to get together. As long, of course, as Finns used English and thus the others could understand them. How bad that was for the movement? In some ways it was bad. That very year, John Penninley was fired from failing to stop the organizing. He was replaced by Charles Trezona. Trezona saw his charges on Vermilion Ranch as needing rougher treatment and called on the police forces from Duluth to arrest the organizers. Because of it, in early 1904, less than a year from Trezona's first day at the job, about 600 workers went on strike and signed a resolution that they were willing to lynch Trezona unless he leaves Vermilion Ranch in 24 hours. As measures on both sides of conflict became more desperate, the strike grew. Soon Trezona was hated not just in small mining towns like Tower and Sudan, but even in Ely. Less than a week from beginning of the strike, then-mayor of Ely ordered for Trezona to be put on the first train from Ely, where he was hiding, to Duluth, and simultaneously for all bars and taverns in town to be closed. With despise Charles Trezona, the mining captain of Oliver Mining Company, out of sight, Vermilion Ranch workers went back to work. Through the incidents like these, by the time of 1900s, when the language barrier started to melt away, people have found new identity, identity of laborers.
And so that idea that a lot of different people came together, and then the labor history of the area thrown in there with that, the unionizing, the strikes, the battles, the defeats, and then ultimately the victories, it created a sense of camaraderie and identity. People, until very recently, who were born here, distinctly and definitively identified themselves as Iron Rangers, and that was something separate and distinct from just being from Minnesota.
Back to the mine. And fast forward 20 years, from the World War II to 1962, when a Sudan mine was closed. Since you could hear the mine all your life, the noise of two-story high ore crusher and the larrikas and dynamite explosions, you feel like the heart of Sudan stopped. Most likely you will move on to next mine, taconite operation this time, and continue to live a pretty similar life. But by the 1980s you will come back to Tower Sudan area, and now you want to go underground again. This time you're a graduate student or a professor in particle physics, and you're looking to answer various questions. Although in the 21st century, your question is, why does the universe weigh so much more than all the stuff in it? You think it is because of the so-called dark matter, the unseen and unrecognizable particles that surround us all, but that are so weak that they don't interact with our world in any way. And if this sci-fi-like stuff excites you, then here are good news. Last year, you almost found what you seek. Angela Reisetter, one of the physicists at Sudan Cryogenic Dark Matter Search Lab, explains what is going on underground now.
So the CDMS experiment is basically we're trying to build a super sensitive detector, and we're waiting to bump into some dark matter. So there should be dark matter all around, and so what we want is a good, clean, cold detector that will
how
tell
clean,
us when we run into dark matter.
I mean,
so
like washing the water in the freezer, or how cold?
So cold, 40 millikelvin, so 0.04 degrees above absolute zero, which is very cold.
The dark matter search started in Stanford, California. But almost immediately they realized that the experiment cannot be conducted on the surface. It has to be in some deep space within the ground to filter out the cosmic rays and regular sun radiation. So Dan Mine was there. And the collaboration, originally out of California, recruited University of Minnesota to help run the experiment.
Well, when they moved up here, they were thinking they wanted to have a Minnesota group. They were already moving in when we joined.
Mm-hmm.
And so the cryopad was being set up. There was some work done on the surface, but the clean room was just coming together. Everything had to come down that cage, down the shaft, and get put together once we were under here. So a lot of techs from Fermilab were putting that together, and I spent a lot of time here in the early days. The worst part about the early days is we hadn't figured out, you know, where to eat and where to go to have fun yet, right? So we were always going to the same little bar in tower because that's the only place we knew to get food.
The data from the super cold detector is recorded automatically, and then once a year the so-called data box is opened. After that, it's a game of statistics. The more events there are, the more likely that the lab have found the dark matter, and the Sudan, Minnesota, is on the map again.
What I understand, last year there were two events.
Yes. Yes, there were two events. So we have this blind analysis process where we take everything from the signal region and set it aside, decide what signal and background look like, and then we have this process where we open the box. And as we're getting ready for it, you know, everybody's taking bets, like, how many do you think is going to be in there, you know? And somebody asked me, and I said, I don't know, yeah, I'm tired, I'm busy, but let me tell you, anything but two, that would make me happy. As long as it's not two events, I would be happy.
What's about two?
Because our expected background was 0.6 events. So if we had seen zero or one events, then you'd say, okay, definitely that's background. That is nothing interesting. If we see three or four or five events, that starts to get really exciting, then maybe we found dark matter. But two is in no man's land. It's like not quite a background and not quite its signal. It's just a big fat we don't know. And that's exactly what happened when we opened the box. So I was watching that, I was on the phone with everybody, and somebody said, oh, it's two events. It was like, no! Because now you have to explain statistics to everyone, and there's no answer. There's no yes, we found it, or no, we didn't. It's just a maybe.
So as of now, there is no result yet. But perhaps they will find it in the next few years. Then the future of Sudan on Vermilion Ranch will be bright again. And until then, the mine's tower and the old ore crusher and the deepest iron mine in the country are waiting. They saw the waves of immigrants come and make Minnesota their home. And just like any other place in 1900s industrial America, the mine had its share of union versus management fights. And it supported the war effort, letting women for the first time to work alongside of men. And now it could be joining the new world, world of complex ideas about universe and science. The mine tower still stands, through the years, overlooking the Vermilion Range, over the strange place in Minnesota called Sudan. For KFAI, this was Elena Ерофеева. Funding for Mini Culture on KFAI comes from listeners like